there a doctor in the house?
Hey, it's Dr. Lisa, and it's time for Dr. Lisa Gives a Shit. I really do give a shit. You know that? I give a shit about this festival that I'm planning. We're going to have a fundraiser. I just found out yesterday. I organized it. So tune in. It's going to be July 7th, 7 to 9, out here in Bushwick. It's going to be called the Selfie Help Festival. So I want you to know that, and I want to thank you for listening. And this is going to be, like, so crazy what's going on here today. Okay, so I'm just going to tell you. I have two people in the studio. I don't even know how to explain who these people are. Okay, I'm going to get through this really quickly. I'm going to try and make this really concise so I don't lose you right in the beginning. So there's two people. There's one, they're both very attractive, male, female, you know, but they're going to be busy on the radio, so don't even think about anything like that. I will, though. I'll take pictures. You can do whatever you want with them. So anyway, I have a lovely gentleman, Christian Nydick. I should know how to pronounce your name. What's your name?
Needon.
Needon. What am I doing? That's because I only call you Christian. Christian and I are friends, but more than friends, we're both very involved in art and writing and the whole, like, Bushwick community and beyond that. And Christian is somebody who's got a real talent for, like, organizing and curating other talent besides his own talents of writing and everything else.
Thanks.
And does that sound accurate? You're going to go with that?
Most definitely.
Okay, good. And so when Christian and I were talking about, like, he's got to be on my radio show, he was like, as usual, did his curating thing. And he brought in somebody who is, like, impossible for me to describe, but I'm going to describe her in a way that I can describe her. So her name is Lilith Marcus.
Lilith.
Rhymes with delete.
Lilith Marcus. We just met 10 minutes ago, though I've been reading about her. And the thing that so Christian told me a lot. Like, Christian wrote me the longest private message I've ever received on Facebook in his attempt to describe her. And then I tried to, like, do my own research. And then Christian and I actually had a meeting about it and the whole thing. And I just want to express my extreme anger that there is no wiki page on this person.
Oh, I never thought about that. That's right.
Why?
Not that I've checked, but there isn't.
No, I checked. I'm telling you. There really should be. So I'm just going to, like, this is how I described it on my Facebook post. Okay, mostly she's a travel editor, digital?
Yes.
At Condé Nast. Talk a little closer to the mic, please. Which is, like, her biggest thing right now, you know. So she's got this plum job it's not that she's getting paid. It's just, like, getting paid is only part of it. It's her job where she is just traveling around the world and having the most interesting time and then writing. Like, we're all jealous. Who wouldn't be? Except some asshole who's probably listening going, like, fuck, I wouldn't want to have to get off my couch to go do some work, go anywhere. And then she also wrote this book, Save the Assistants, A Guide for Surviving and Thriving in the Workplace, which I think, if I read correctly, Lilith, rhymes with delete.
See, it works every time.
It does. It's good. Thank you. Lilith, you wrote this, I'm assuming, in the beginning of your career when you were assistant to some douchehead.
Correct.
Okay, good. So that's a completely different thing, although, you know, it involves writing, but it's nothing to do with travel writing. So that's weird. And then she's a child of deaf parents. Is that true, too?
That is correct.
Do you know Cambry Cruz?
I do, yeah.
Oh, are you guys friends?
Yeah, I know her. I've been to her place in Queens.
Yeah, yeah, yes, Cambry. And then she also has a Cambry's awesome. She's in my archives, but I've tried to. She was in my BAM project. I did a big interview with her there. You could find it on the BAM website if you're interested in hearing about her amazing life. She is also Lilith is also known for having strong views about remaining child free.
That is also true.
Now, that strikes a deep chord with me.
Yeah?
A woman after my own heart. Yeah. So I am really, but you're really young. Especially compared to me. How old are you, Lily?
I'm old enough that I don't think I can be called young.
Okay, so 30s.
Yeah.
Okay. But young enough to still be you're fertile.
No,
you get your period?
I guess ostensibly. I think I ovulate sand at this point.
Come on. Well, why would you not be getting your period or any of that? Like, what? You don't want to have kids, but you're just as fertile as everybody else.
I mean, I've never actually
found
out.
Don't be in denial about not your ability to have a baby. That could be very dangerous.
Here's the thing, though. Like, I've just never bothered to find out if I can or can't. Like, when you don't want to, you don't really think about the logistics of it.
Okay, but are you hetero?
Yeah, usually.
Okay, and do you have sex?
Not for a while, no.
Oh, you're pretty celibate then?
Not voluntarily, no.
Is that because of the traveling?
Yeah, travel makes it really, really hard to date when you have my job.
So, but are you meeting? Like, do you get asked out? I mean, I would guess. Or are guys afraid? Guys are a little afraid of you. It's true, aren't they?
Do you think so?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah. Oh, yeah.
I can't imagine anyone being afraid of me. Like, I've met dogs bigger than me, like, this morning.
No. So let's go back to Christian, because I love Christian. He's laughing. I just want to make sure Christian's part of this, because he's got it going on. So tell me a little bit about your – first of all, you know what? I would want to ask you, Christian. So
yes.
How long did you guys – you guys knew each other from working at Hebe magazine, right?
No, that was my mistake. I misremember this. This is actually really interesting that I knew – I was working – for a place called the Jewish Channel, which was a Jewish television station at the time.
It literally is a Jewish channel.
And my name literally is Christian, so it got even weirder. And we, around 2009, I want to say, we started doing a weekly news broadcast. And one of the first stories, I think very early on, I interviewed Lalit when she was part of Juicy, which was another, I believe,
Jewish remember that.
Humor culture
site. Yeah, no, it's still around.
Is it still around?
It's owned by Tablet now, but at the time it was independent.
And I'm actually wearing a shirt that Lalit gave me that day, now, here in studio.
For the Jews listening to this, it has a shin on it.
Yes.
I don't even know what that is.
It's the thing that looks like a W, if you've seen Hebrew writing.
Oh, I know what you mean. Yeah, well, we'll get the pictures. We'll get the pictures you can see.
It means a lot. I've had the shirt for 7 years now.
Aww.
So. And I'm more than happy to play hype man to Lalit, because from the first time I interviewed her, she was very thoughtful, articulate.
So you met her interviewing her for the Jew Channel.
We had there was a roundtable show called The Editors, where they would kind of get editors of different Jewish publications across the spectrum, and we would just sort of talk. It was like The View, but really boring.
So what was Christian? What was your job? What was your job on it?
I was a cameraman.
Oh.
So one of the things I think. I think I might have talked to Lalit as part of like a field intro piece or something now at this point. But Lalit was actually our first two-time guest on that show. And she was also a two-time guest on another show we did. It was a women's roundtable show called The Salon.
Yeah, that's the one that Rachel Sklar hosted?
That is.
Yes.
Oh, Rachel Sklar. I kind of know her, I think. So you guys...
So met professionally.
But did you hang out after that? Or
yeah.
I mean, because that's not enough to like actually make a friendship out of, right?
The first time, we would talk before and after the shows. We're very, very friendly. And one of the things, I think I became Facebook friends with Lalit. And one of the things I went to was, I believe, a dinner at Trafe in Williamsburg.
Yeah. So I used to live in Williamsburg. Christian lives in Williamsburg. And I wanted to organize a Hanukkah party, but I really didn't want to do the work and have people over to my house and cook. And so there's this great restaurant called Trafe, which I love because the name means not kosher in Hebrew. And all the food they serve is like pork and shellfish. And so I thought, what better than to throw a giant Hanukkah party at Trafe
and
invite a bunch of my friends? So I did.
And it was really cool for me because it was a mix of Jews and non-Jews fitting at a place called Trafe in the heart of this neighborhood where there's a lot of Hasidic Jews. And for me at the time, and still through my 7 years at the Jewish Channel, it was kind of this immersive.
7 years. Wow.
7 years. And I learned a lot about Jewish, about Judaism of all stripes, without actually being Jewish. And it was really interesting to have, you know, out of that, I have friends still that I met through the channel.
Look like you could be Jewish. Did people mistake
well,
you for being?
Well, usually once his name came out, yeah. He's really
yeah,
quick.
Yeah, that's true. But he could sort of fit in, though.
My grandfather is full-blooded Ashkenazi.
Oh, yeah, we had that discussion.
Cool, so is mine.
Yeah.
So you guys sort of, like, you know, wound up, like, probably, like, hanging out in the same circles and things like that too. Or?
Most definitely, yeah. And she and also Elite also did me a solid when I was looking to do a freelance article. One of the great talents that she has is that she's a fantastic. She's almost like a freelance article ninja. She knows how to really find the places to get her work out. And so I saw that, was looking for a place to publish a article about a friend of mine who was a reality game show game designer. He would design challenges, and he had associates that. And she in turn helped me find an associate and good friend of hers, who's now a friend of mine, Natalie Zutter, who was running a part of Crushable, I believe, at the time.
Oh, yeah, cool. It's a pop culture site.
Yeah.
And that was one of Lalit's stops when she was over. I believe you were at the Gloss at that time.
Yes, which was at the time owned by the same people, but the site has since been shut down.
So you guys have networked your careers a bit here.
Yeah.
I guess for me, I don't necessarily think of it as networking. In situations like this, it feels really seamless when it's somebody you already know and you just have a good idea for somebody.
Cynically. I'm being cynical. Well, whatever. Yeah,
But it seems to, it's kind of like kismet in that way.
Look, if you can't have friends that can further your career, why be friends with them? See what I'm saying? That's my point of view.
That's why I hang out with you.
So Christian, I want to ask you this.
Sure.
So, like, you have seen Lalit out socially.
Yes.
Right? She is a very dynamic, extremely intelligent, open person, right?
Absolutely.
Very attractive, I think.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
So
very
do you so. Think that guys are, like, straight guys might be afraid of her?
Not at all.
You don't think so?
And I've met some of those guys. So it's I don't think so at all. I think, you know, especially being in New York, I think it's been tough because I go through this in the opposite way. It's tough to, I guess you used the word networking before, and especially when you, I think your professional life definitely plays a part in the circles that you run in.
Absolutely.
And so one of the cool things, I'll give you an example of something that one of the cool things I like about Lalit and her friends is they like doing this. One of the pictures that I sent out to promote this very event was a picture that we took at Sunshine Cinema.
Right.
To watch a midnight screening of The Room. Now, if people don't know The Room,
it's the greatest film ever made.
Yeah, I kind of want to see that.
Oh, Lisa, you have to.
You have to come with
us. Yeah, well, okay. Are you guys going to see it?
It's the first weekend of every month, Friday and Saturday at midnight.
Oh my God, I can't wait.
Yeah, you go gotta bring every beer. We don't go every month, but that's when they have it. So we can pop in whenever we want.
Oh.
Yeah, it's pretty great.
Sign me up. Phil, my husband Phil won't see it, you know.
Really?
Yeah, because, you know, it's upsetting or something. I don't know. He doesn't want to be brought down. It's too much.
Oh.
It's phenomenal. Like, it makes you feel so happy at the end.
Oh, really? Maybe I can tell him that.
It's an important communal experience.
Well, he loves Christians, so if I say Christians going, then we'll go.
My point for bringing it up, though, is that I think people who go to see The Room, it's an important bellwether of your sense of humor.
Right.
Absolutely. And I think it's something that's similar to people who enjoy, say, Spinal Tap.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
In that sense. And the communal aspect is really great, too, because it's something where people, you just, it's one of those things where you kind of just get it. You know, you go there and people recite lines, or they're tossing a football around in the theater,
like the Rocky Horror Picture Show.
Well, one thing that's different is that you're supposed to change it up every time. So with Rocky Horror, it's like you wear costumes and it's very much like winking. But with The Room, there might be certain things everybody yells every time, but you're really encouraged to like try and say something funny that nobody has ever said before.
Oh,
and
you
if
really
you do,
sold
like, you
me.
Win.
Oh, yeah. Really?
Really?
Oh,
should do
I
it,
can't
Lisa.
Wait to go. I'll probably
it's
wind up go, having to go again.
That's one side of it. That's one side of the idea of like finding people who have your sense of humor, who are like
right,
to do
right,
stuff
right,
when you're
right,
off the clock.
Right.
getting back to the Jewish side, though, this is something I'd ask Lalit about. When I was working at the Jewish Channel, there would be times where, you know, I'd approach a lady of the Jewish persuasion. Usually, if they're mm-hmm. and the more Orthodox they were, the bigger the deal breaker of whether or not you were Jewish was a thing.
Right.
Now, I had the luxury as kind of a tourist in that world of who I wanted to date. I don't think would you say you're encumbered by that? It doesn't necessarily mean that you have to. Are you always looking for Jewish?
No, I would say that honestly, being child free means that I can't be as choosy about that particular aspect of it. I find that more of the Jewish men I've dated wanted children than didn't, and that became a big sticking point for them.
Mm.
So since that's not something that I'm ever interested in doing, it is less important to me that someone is of the same background as me.
But I mean, are you from the kind of background that if that was an issue, you'd be... Like, I didn't...
No,
I
my parents are interfaith.
Oh, yeah.
It's never been a big problem.
I've never given a shit. I have dated a lot of Jewish guys just because that's who I've run into. But yeah, my husband's a goy.
Yeah, no, my parents actually, I think it's kind of interesting. My parents are interfaith, and my mom's side is Christian, my dad's side is Jewish. But I think had other relatives on my father's side of the family not married someone Jewish, it would have been a very big deal. And I think that because my parents are deaf, there was a certain worry that they would never meet someone. There was a belief like, oh, our poor deaf children, what are they going to do? Mm-hmm. And because they found each other, everybody said, okay, great, do whatever you want. And in a way, they were really liberated from that kind of requirement.
They weren't from deaf families.
No.
Okay. And what I wanted to ask you though was why are you so adamant against having children?
I don't know if I would even say I'm adamant anymore. It's just such a part of who I am that I'm just blasé about it now. I think mm-hmm. when I was younger, when I kind of figured out, oh my God, there's a word for people like me and there's a movement and I'm not alone in the woods here, I think that was when I got really militant about it and I was like, breeders, no way, man. But I think I've evolved beyond that, just that like it's not something that I want to do, but it's such a small part of my life at this point, I almost mm-hmm. forget about it.
But it must have struck a chord with you at some point. Was it that you feel like women are encumbered by it, or what was it?
I don't know if encumbered is the word that I would use, but it's another one of the expectations that our society pushes on women that mm-hmm. no matter what decision they make, it's wrong.
Right. Did you feel like your parents really wanted you to have kids?
I do. My parents are very traditional. My mm-hmm. mom was a stay-at-home mom, and she loved it. But mm-hmm. I think they understand, and I've talked about it with them, and a lot of people assume that if you don't want children, it's because you had a really fucked up childhood and something really bad happened to you.
Right.
And that's not the case for me at all. I think I'm just wired this way.
Mm-hmm.
And being
mm-hmm.
able to explain that to my parents and make sure that they understood that it's nothing to do with them
right.
really
right.
helped them to understand that it wasn't personal in that
right.
way.
So how was growing up with deaf parents? What did your parents do?
My dad was a computer programmer, and mm-hmm. my mom was a stay-at-home mom.
So they're being deaf. Did that really affect them too much? Or it sounds like it sounds like you had a pretty happy childhood. That's what I'm getting.
Yeah.
Do you have brothers and sisters?
I have a younger sister. Mm-hmm. We're about 2.5 years apart. Mm-hmm.
And were your parents born deaf, both of them? Or?
Yeah, it's a little complicated. My dad was born deaf and my mom became deaf very shortly after birth. She was severely premature in the 1950s in a small North mm-hmm. Carolina hospital.
Right. Mm.
And they thought she was going to die. They gave her an experimental medicine. It saved her life. It killed her hearing.
Right. So they have somewhat similar, you know, they come together in a similar way.
Yeah. I mean, I should mention that most deaf people don't come from deaf families. It's not usually genetic.
Yeah. Oh, okay. That makes sense,
so,
I guess.
Yeah. And most deaf people are likely to have hearing children. So it is something that they think about. There's a whole school of thought about, you mm-hmm. know, how best to raise your kid. Mm-hmm. And it's a pretty common thing.
Mm-hmm. So it sounds like, I mean, being deaf, of course, is a challenge, or there's probably a lot of great things about it as well. But it sounds like you had a fairly normal childhood in spite of that your parents had an unusual quality.
Yeah, in some ways it felt like the most normal thing in the world, and then every once in a while I would sort of look around and realize we were the only people like us. I grew up in the South. I'm from North Carolina. And occasionally people would stop and ask me if my family was Italian.
Why?
And I was like, oh, you think that we're just like making hand gestures like Italian people you saw on TV. Yeah,
that's so funny.
They had this stereotype of Italian people as like waving their hands around while they talk.
Oh, that's hilarious.
I was like, no, what are you talking about? They're just deaf. Like, those are signs.
Right. So you're really good at all that signing and all that stuff.
It's my first language,
yeah,
I hope so.
Right, and that's probably made you really flexible at learning other languages, right?
I think so. I mean, my sister
You know a lot of languages, is that right? Did I read
that? I know a few, but my sister would say totally not. And we have the same parents, and yet she's awful at languages, and I'm good at them, so who knows how much of it is nurture and nature,
Right.
Sorry to out my sister like that.
Is that something also, I was curious, like when you're abroad traveling, it's known as American Sign Language.
Yes.
Are there other dialects across the spectrum?
They're not dialects. They're other languages. British Sign Language is completely different. I can't understand a word of it. It uses a totally different alphabet.
Wow, that's so interesting.
Yeah, so American Sign Language is the most close to French Sign Language.
That's interesting, because American Sign Language, as I understand it, what my exposure to it, it seems very, expressive. Like, I feel like when I'm watching people doing it, I sort of get what they mean without saying it.
Well,
keep
in mind that every sign language comes from the visual context of the community that it grows up in.
Right.
So if you ask a kid in America to draw a picture of a flower, they're going to draw a different picture than a kid from another country.
Right.
So it's about the flowers you see. And I try to picture it that way. Like, it looks familiar to you because visually it's supposed to look similar.
Right. So anyway, Lilit.
See, look at that.
Yeah, I'm getting better. Thanks for that tip. I'm wondering, like, okay, so to me, you're like this ridiculous overachiever, just ridiculous. You're obviously very, very bright and talented and really good writer and all that. I mean, there's no question about that. But you've also created so much stuff and made so much happen, stuff that you've done on your own, like, you know, writing a book and that kind of stuff. So here's what I find so fascinating about you is that the accomplishments that you've had in your life are fairly diverse, right?
Yes.
But there must be a common thread about you in them. And I'm also wondering why you're so driven. I think you're driven. I'm going to say that. What do you think, Christian? Do you think that Lilit is driven? What's your point? What's your take on it?
I think she's hardworking. I think that's something that definitely I've connected with her on that side is that she goes through her day making sure to take care of the commitments that she's made. And that's deceptively simple statement because not everybody does that. Especially, like I said before, an interesting thing about Lilit is that she's taken this approach, which is terrifying to me, which is this freelancer's approach of articles. A big chunk of her career, I would say, is basically coming up with stuff to do.
Do you have to pitch most of that stuff?
I do, yeah. Even at my job, even though I'm on staff now. I mean, I was a full-time freelance travel writer for about 5 years before I took this job.
Mm-hmm.
But you have to be in that mindset all the time. Even when you're in a newsroom, you don't necessarily get handed assignments. It's, you know, people have beats and you have stuff that you're good at, but there's a lot of, oh, well, I really want to cover this, and I'm going to tell you why, and here's why you should pay for me to go here.
Definition of a self-starter.
Yeah, so your success is really, it's really dependent on your own motivation. This is what I'm saying. I mean, and not to I mean, people should know that there's a lot of passion behind that. It's not like you're just driven. I mean,
I don't think driven is a bad term at all. I'm really excited to be called driven.
Right, but I mean, it's something you really enjoy and feel strongly about. So
yeah,
it's not like you're like, you know, trying to get ahead or get to be the top of the heap or something, like, you know, it's not just a goal for the sake of getting ahead.
Right. But I mean, I do want to be the best at what I do.
Yes. And we want you to do that too. So, Christian, what would you imagine? How do you think Lilit would be described at work? Like, what do you think? Like,
well, I can tell you just from personal experience, when we booked her at the Jewish Channel, one of the things that we really valued about her was she was kind of almost like a ringer when it came to having to fill a chair, because she could talk about anything. She had a diversity of interests. Now, again, that was a relatively narrow focus of the Jewish world, but
But even within that, one week I came in and there was a Jewish candidate for Miss America. Then we switched into talking about Israeli politics. Then we talked about Israeli athletes in the World Cup. I mean, there was a ton of stuff. And Jewish may seem quite narrow, but within that, you can kind of go all over the place.
So, and the other thing in that, sorry to interrupt, is that her statements would never be stock. She had an opinion on those. And that is really important for what we needed. And that's something that again, it's somebody who's well-read, someone who engages with the world. One other thing, too, is that I believe you've had, and maybe still do, have an ongoing relationship with The Forward and submitting stuff there. And I know that the editorial staff at The Forward really values having not necessarily a hot take, but, you know, a definitive opinion for their editorials that they shop for. And the fact that Lilith's had multiples of those is an achievement.
So what do you think, Christian, is the, I mean, we were going through that, there's quite an array of achievements. So what do you think the common thread is? What would you imagine? Can you say?
Actually, can I? Can
yes,
I?
Please.
Go,
yeah.
Go ahead. So I was thinking about this recently when Christian sort of brought up coming on the show. It felt like being on This Is Your Life, which is exciting.
Oh, well, that's nice.
So I was thinking about it. And I've been hanging out recently with an author I really admire who's also a CODA. That's what we're called.
Yeah,
Children
right.
of Deaf Adults.
Yeah, I know that from Cambry, right.
Yeah. So he pointed out that we're both generalists and we're both interested in everything. And he thinks that it has a lot to do with when you're the older or oldest kid in a deaf family, you're always the interpreter and you're always an adult. So even when I was seven years old, I sat at the adult's table at Thanksgiving translating for all of my relatives while my sister got to run around and play with the other kids.
Oh, interesting.
And so I think being exposed to a really wide variety of adult conversations that maybe I wasn't even old enough to understand or parse apart or say, who are these politicians you're talking about and what do they think? But it really got me interested in and exposed to a lot of topics really early on. And I think that made me kind of a generalist.
Huh, that's interesting. And also the what happened, I'm sure, is that your opinion was valuable like all the other adults. So you're confident in recognizing your opinion and putting it out there, I think.
Yeah, I think I had to learn to make the case for myself because I would often be the youngest person at the table. So I knew that if I wanted somebody to take me seriously, I had to back up everything. I had to have evidence for what I was going to say. And obviously that suited me well as a journalist. Mm-hmm. That's my job.
Right. No, that makes perfect sense. You seem like you would have been like an A student in school. Is that right?
Only in the humanities. You should have seen my chemistry homework.
And then what happened there? Did you work hard or you didn't? You just aren't talented at it? Or did you not try? Or what happened there?
If you asked all of my teachers from elementary school, they would all tell you that if I'm not interested in something, I won't do it.
Hmm.
That was the feedback I got pretty regularly. So, yeah, I didn't really care about algebra, so I just didn't.
Same here.
Yeah.
Same here. I felt the same way.
I didn't do well, but I felt bad about it. That's how I was brought up. That was my motivation. That was my parents' motivation.
People made me feel bad about it, but my heart wasn't in it.
Did you get in trouble were your parents like always thinking that you were doing great or?
No, I mean, they knew. It's hard to explain the weirdness of translating your own parent-teacher conference.
Weird. Oh, so you were there.
Legally, according to the law, you are supposed to always have an interpreter for stuff like that in anything public. So that includes public school, but that doesn't mean that everyone does it or that they have the money to do it.
Right,
so
exactly.
Sometimes weird scenarios happen.
Oh, weird. That is weird.
Because you got to lie, but you have to lie in a way that matches their face and body expressions, which is really hard to do.
Oh, that's really funny. Did you lie?
I tried, but like they still get a report card at the end of it. So
that's hilarious.
Really, yeah,
great.
It's just not worth it, honestly.
That's great. Where did you go to college?
I went to UNC Greensboro in North Carolina.
Mm-hmm. And so that sounds like that sounds like that would give you a lot of confidence. You know, being in the, having to, being in charge of your parents gave you a lot of responsibility.
Yeah, I don't know if I would say they gave it to me, to be honest. I think there were times that my parents were really frustrated. And I've seen this a lot in the deaf community where I think a lot of deaf people would prefer to advocate for themselves and prefer to do things on their own. But for whatever reason, they can't because of language barriers or lack of an interpreter. So they get really infantilized in a lot of ways, especially by like doctors and social workers and people in the legal profession. It can be very hard to push against that. And a lot of deaf people find themselves so frustrated because they're perfectly capable of telling you how they feel and what they want. They just don't have the same language as you to do it.
Right, right, right. I could see that. So did you go through a rebellious phase ever?
Like, I mean, who didn't? Yeah, totally.
When was that? Can you picture that, Christian?
I think I can. You know, it might just be rebellious, the very act of leaving North Carolina. I can imagine just the idea of, you know, after spending your youth there, then going to college there, now leaving that, I'm not going to necessarily say bubble, but that area to go.
Small town.
Yeah.
Small town. Yeah, that was probably rebellious. That probably took balls.
Yeah, I mean, it wasn't very common where I'm from. A lot of people after college would move to New York for maybe 2 years, and then mm-hmm. they would come home and get married. So there was this idea that you moved to New York for a while. Mm-hmm. I've never had more guests come to visit me in New York than I did first 2 years that I lived here, because I think there was this implicit understanding that at the end of that, I would get it out of my system and move home, and then I didn't.
So that's pretty funny. So, yeah, I guess that would, well, it must have been hard to leave your parents, though, was it? I mean, were you worried about them? Who interprets for them now?
You know, honestly, technology has gone so far beyond what I ever thought it would do.
Yeah, it's so easy now, right?
I text with my parents. I FaceTime with my parents.
Right.
No, I hear from them more now than I did when I was in college.
So do they enjoy that? I mean, do they enjoy the technology in general, not just with you? But
absolutely.
Has that liberated everybody a bit?
Yeah.
Given everybody freedom. That's great. That's a great
fantastic thing
to think about, you know? So was your goal always to be a travel writer?
I want to say yes, but I don't think that would be fair because I don't think I knew this job existed when I was a kid. I didn't know anybody who was a journalist.
No, I mean, when you moved to New York, since you've been writing.
I think so.
Since the assistant book, you must have been really angry after having a lot of responsibility at home and then being treated like assistants are treated. Is that what happened there?
That's a really good way of pointing it out. I don't know if I ever would have thought of it that way. But yeah, I think for me, I grew up in a kind of community where going to college was still really important and where a college degree really meant something, instead of in New York, where it's kind of the baseline thing you have to do just to get any job. So where I grew up, if you had a university degree, you were the boss. And if you didn't, you were the assistant. So it was really strange for me to come to New York and start as somebody's assistant. And I had thought for years, but now I'm a big successful career lady, only to find out that I actually was going to have to answer some dude's phone for a couple of years first.
Right, and that was hard,
and that was hard for me to negotiate. And I think where Save the Assistants came from, it started as a blog, and it was because I realized I didn't have the cultural capital to understand what a modern office was like. I didn't know how to write a professional email. I had never worked in a corporate environment before. I didn't know what to do when I got yelled at for shit that wasn't my fault.
So you wound up getting angry. You didn't wind up feeling like you were not doing your job or failing or anything like that.
I did feel like I was failing for a while. I think what really changed was I went and I took a different assistant job. It was the exact same work, but for a really great person. And for me, that's when it all changed. I realized, I'm still, quote unquote, paying my dues. I sort of hate that expression. But I'm still at the bottom of my career learning about journalism, learning about what I want to do. I'm working for somebody really accomplished, but I'm not miserable. And he treats me really well.
Closer to the mic. Closer to the mic, Lilith.
All right. How's that?
Better.
So, yeah, I think that was the main difference, is that I had the exact same on-paper job, and yet working for a person who was inspiring.
Right.
Yeah, and who really was a mentor.
Were there male-female issues? Were they both males and females?
Yeah, both guys.
Both guys. Mm-hmm. Interesting. So, is that when you decided you want to be a travel writer?
I think I realized that I liked being a journalist. I had chosen the career that I wanted to have, and yet I was spending all of my time and money getting away from my journalism job to go travel. And it occurred to me, why am I not doing the same thing?
Oh, I see. Oh, that's cool.
And this, if I could say something else.
Yeah, I was just going to ask if you've known Lilith through the transition, Christian.
Well, yes.
Yeah, absolutely. I've seen her at different stops. And one of the great things, again, about Facebook and social media stuff is that I've been able to see Lilith come back and post a lot of these things and see the angle that she's taken on this stuff. I remember the first one that really touched, or the first one I can remember is, I remember you went to Taiwan to the little town that's like...
Oh, Zhoufen.
Oh,
yeah.
My God. It's like the Spirited Away town.
That town is awesome.
Yeah, from the, was it Miyazaki? Yeah, the famous Spirited Away animated film. And it's based on that. And I remember you went there, and that was your angle for crafting that whole article and the photos and other stuff. It's like, wow, that's a really cool thing to think to do. When you're at, because it's at Land's End of Taiwan, right?
Yeah.
It's like at the extreme north, yes. I think it is. And then just recently connecting that with other stuff, I remember so Lily recently went to Cambodia, which I believe you had, did you have some preconceived notions, some reservations about going to Phnom Penh?
I did, yeah. I mean,
yeah, I was going to say, you're pretty ballsy. Is she pretty ballsy? Or where's the fearless,
absolutely.
Where's the fearlessness come from?
Oh, it's all an act.
Oh. Is it?
Yeah, I have crazy imposter syndrome, and I just have to talk myself out of it. I just have to go and do it. And as soon as I get somewhere, it's like, this is great. I love it. Why didn't I come here sooner? But I just have to make myself do it.
So you have a lot of anxiety before you do things you want to do them. You have a hunger to do them, but you're anxious about it.
I mean, I'm still Jewish. So
this is true.
And I think you're pretty self-effacing about it, even in your writing. I think in your Cambodia, I think in the first couple of sentences, you said, I had a notion about what this was going to be before I went there, and I'm so glad that it proved me wrong.
I think that kind of transparency is important, because travel, possibly more than even other forms of journalism, is dominated by wealthy white men who can afford to travel independently.
Right.
And so as a result, I mean, they can go to places that not all of us can go to, and they can feel safe in places that not all of us feel safe.
Right.
And I think it's really important to be straightforward about that kind of information. And as a single woman traveling alone, there are certain places where I act differently or where I notice things differently, and other women will too. I think it's really irresponsible not to mention that.
Mm-hmm. So do you ever feel threatened? You must.
Yeah, there have definitely been moments where, like, I was walking around, I was staying at this hostel in Athens, and it was 24 hours because I arrived at like 4:30 in the morning. Mm-hmm. But it was 24 hours and the train station was open and it was 10 minutes walk away, so I just walked over. But it was a Sunday morning, so nobody was up and about, and this guy just started following me, wouldn't leave me alone, started talking to me in Greek, like kept trying to touch me. And it was the longest 10-minute walk of my entire life, like just getting to the front door of that place without him attacking me and like just trying to run for it.
Right, right. Mm. But you persevered. So that there's a lot of satisfaction in that, right? A lot of strength, a lot of growth.
I hope so. But I also don't want to make women who were less lucky than me feel like they did something wrong.
Of course not. I don't think they will. They shouldn't. We know this. But it's good that you're saying it.
Yeah, and I just think that that's what happens when you bring diverse voices into these kinds of conversations.
No, it's good that you're doing that. It's excellent.
I'd have a question about that. So, like, at Condé Nast, is the makeup of contributing editors or writers like you, is there a gender diversity there?
Yeah,
on the staff?
Absolutely. And I feel like my boss in particular has been really great about promoting that. And then other stuff that you have to think about with travel too is, does the person speak the local language? Do they live there? Do they have some kind of personal connection? Why are they writing about this particular location? Because everybody thinks that they can just go on vacation and become a travel writer. Mm. They think, like, oh, I went to Hawaii. I want to try and monetize my vacation. I'm going to sell an article about it. But I'd much rather hear from somebody who lives there, who's been to everything in the area and can tell you which ones are good and which ones are bad. And so you run into a lot of, like, dilettantism, if that makes sense.
Right. So you're trying to report the real thing. More like the Lonely Planet guide, sort of, but maybe more
I would say the Condé Nast
intellectual
guide.
Yeah, because Condé Nast is a lot more, it's a very sophisticated, I mean, I think of it as like, what are the really interesting places to go? And it's not just about budget either.
Right, absolutely. I mean, we have a lot of latitude, which is really nice. Mm-hmm. I mean, we've covered all kinds of places that I would kill to go to. And some of us get really jealous of each other in the office.
Oh, I bet. So yeah, anyway, this is really consuming your life right now in a way that you're happy with, right?
Absolutely.
That's great. That's really great. So here, I'm going to throw this out as a self-proclaimed psychotherapist observation. Let's give this a shot, all right?
Well, this is where the doctor part comes in.
Okay,
right?
So I want to get back to talking about your boyfriend since you're single. And like, I can't, there's no obvious reason why, and Christian can't explain it either. So, I'm going to say this. I think perhaps when you were growing up, that you had a weird role in your family being kind of like sort a child, but also sort of an authority figure?
Maybe.
And maybe really self-sufficient in a way, because you couldn't, your parents depended on you in ways that they couldn't depend, that in ways that they really needed to, right? That were pretty profound. Did you feel like that?
I don't know. I think when you're a kid, however you grow up is just your life, and it's hard to think about it as an outsider, if that makes any sense.
Right. But I think, like, what I guess I'm trying to articulate here is that this feeling of being like a kid that doesn't know anything, like, did you, I don't think you had a lot of that.
Oh, I did. It just way later, in college for sure. I just showed up one day and I think for a long time, I thought that culture was this thing that happened in other places and I wasn't invited and that I would have to move to New York or LA and that was it. And now, obviously, these kids grow up in this world where they have the internet and everything happens on Snapchat. But I definitely had a rude awakening, you know, showing up my first day of college and then showing up in New York and realizing I'd never worked in an office before and suddenly now I had to and everybody knew so much more about the world than I did.
Right. And the point, I mean, from my point, my theory is, so what I'm trying to, So in other words, the way that you were brought up, you didn't question what you were going to need to know or what they were going to tell you to do or how to fit in and all that. Like, you did get to have to experience that, but I think that when you perhaps were growing up, you could take for granted that you knew what was going on.
Yeah, I hope so.
Yeah, but I'm just saying, Christian, does this make any sense to you?
Yes, it does.
Okay, and, you know, why don't you say it?
Okay, yeah. I mean, like, as somebody who grew up much closer to home here in New York, in Jersey City, I think I grew up in a little bit of a bubble as well. And that's not as well. I don't want to put that onto the lead.
God forbid.
But for me, I felt like I grew up in a bubble in terms of cultures, being, you know, one white kid in a neighborhood full of Puerto Rican kids. And the idea that I went to public school briefly and then I went to private school, and the idea of, like, who I interacted with, who my friends were, informed, you know, how I socialized with people or how, you know, what girls I pursued and or if I did that at all. And then there's, like, you know, random stuff. Like, I got sent to boarding school when I was in a sophomore, an all-boys boarding school. And if that doesn't fuck with your, you know,
head,
with your romantic development, I don't know what does.
Oh, my God. Man. My dream was to go to boarding school.
Oh, really?
Yeah, because I read, like, The Little Princess and all of those books, and I was dying to go to boarding school.
Oh, because you like traveling. You wanted the adventure, being on your own.
Here's the thing. It's, like, it was weird. That idea of speaking of The Little Princess for a second, the idea of English boarding school, it's so funny. In retrospect, I've talked to other males who went to English boarding schools in England and comparing the experiences. Holy shit, am I glad I went to an American boarding school. English ones sound really, really intense. But yeah, that was something where I could say, like, by the time I hit college, the one thing that I think I had developmentally that was good is that living away from home was a good thing.
Right, you're right.
And that helped me not feel homesick as much. So in
self-reliant.
Exactly. And I made friends.
Unafraid.
And just the idea of, like, just the stuff that in addition to, like, dating in that situation is the idea of, like, joining organizations, developing new friends from scratch, essentially. Those kind of things were, like, things that I pretty much also had to do from scratch, because all of a sudden I was in the co-ed environment for the first time in 4 years.
Oh, shit. That's interesting.
That was huge. And that's that kind of stuff at that age.
Oh, it's a girl! Yeah.
That kind of stuff, like, follows you for your life, but it doesn't, I don't necessarily think it defines me.
Right.
You know, like, I've lived a lot of life since then.
But it's interesting, because both of you have had similar or parallel ways of becoming independent children. Christian, you were sent to a boarding school.
Right.
And Lilith, you had to take on extra responsibility at home as an interpreter, right?
Sure.
So anyway, we only have 15 minutes left, so I'm just going to get down to it. So, Lilith, when was the last time you had a boyfriend?
Oh my God, do we have to talk about this?
Not if you don't want to, but yeah, of course. Christian, do you know anything about this? Like the last time she had a boyfriend?
He's friends with my ex-boyfriend.
Do you?
To be fair though, he helped me at a very critical time in my professional life. So they were both. What happened basically is I knew Lalit and her boyfriend at the time, and after they broke up, I think the way Lalit put it is they're splitting time with me or something. Like it's almost like a
shared custody.
Custody.
Like, that's like when Phil dumps me, like you'll see him sometimes and I'll see you sometimes.
Yeah.
That makes sense.
So
get it.
One of the things is I respect the quality of people that Lalit dates because
yeah,
they're pretty reasonable.
Oh, that
people.
Makes one of us.
That makes
I don't think Lalit would put up with a lot of bullshit.
I mean, regardless of what the final outcome is, no, I don't think so.
And I think
I don't think she's a hard ass though. I don't think that's the thing.
She's not judgmental, but she wouldn't be like if the guy, like a lot of chicks, you know, like they just like the guy and the guy does some fucked up things and they're like, oh, it's all right.
So a good friend of mine, I feel like when you're in your 30s in Brooklyn, all of a sudden all the single people disappear. Like I asked people,
agreed.
Oh, can you introduce me to someone? Like after my ex and I split up, and they were like, oh, I don't actually know anyone who's single. Sorry.
Mm-hmm.
So I feel like every social situation I'm in now, I just assume that everybody is married until I find out otherwise. And yeah, Christian is nodding because he knows.
Yep.
He knows.
No, I totally agree.
Like. Yeah. And so recently I was at my friend's husband's birthday party and it was one of the rare social situations I've been in lately where, like, there were a ton of people I didn't know, which I also feel like happens less now.
Mm, yeah.
So there was maybe one single dude there, and my friend was kind of angling, like, oh, you should go talk to him. And I talked to him, and he had the personality of like, beige wallpaper.
Mm.
He seemed fine. But afterward, I overheard her and her husband talking, and her husband said, oh, I don't think he and Lalit would get along at all. I think Lalit would eat him. And I thought that was the nicest compliment I've ever gotten.
See, this is what I'm saying, and I'm saying this in the best way possible. I wonder if, you need a really tough guy. Not tough, but like a guy who's really like solid in himself, right? Right, Christian?
I don't think there's anything wrong with being picky.
Being picky is great.
That's something I kind of deal with too, and that's
well, you know, unless you're really desperate.
Well, it's true. No, again, I don't want to speak for everybody.
Kidding. If you're really desperate, then you can't be picky.
Yeah.
But I agree. You know, because you're both very busy people. You want your time to be valuable. Your time is valuable. You don't want to waste it with people you
and
don't
enjoy.
And
it's really hard.
And you both have a lot of friends
in this line of work too. Like
why
I love
is that?
What I do, but. I mean, imagine going on a really good first date with someone and then saying, by the way, I'm leaving the country for a month. Like, can we pick this back up when I get back? That's a lot to ask of mm-hmm. people, especially the older you get and the more people really want to dive into a relationship.
Right.
It's hard to stay in touch. It's hard to kind of keep that going, especially if something feels like it has momentum and then all of a sudden you're just gone.
So how long, one of the things I want to do is just check in and make sure that you don't have a big intimacy and obstacle problem. But I don't think I'm not saying you do, but or that you might even, you probably don't.
I will say my last relationship ended. This is not a secret. My last relationship ended because he changed his mind and decided that he wanted children after all.
Oh.
And that was really hard for me because he knew about that before we even started dating. He saw me on the Today Show talking about not wanting children. I don't think it was not a government secret at that point. It came up on the second or third date we ever went on. He was really cool with it and felt the same way until he didn't. And I think that was really tough because growing up, I always believed that all women wanted children and all men didn't. And that it was something women talked men into wanting. And it was strange for me to be in the complete opposite of that situation.
You know, it's interesting because I went through something similar, being single all through my 30s and not wanting children. It was just something I wasn't interested in. And I didn't assume that guys wanted them either because that was the game that everybody played, like
right.
that girls want the babies. But I have about 5 boyfriends from that period that I look on back on, and they all have kids. It's really funny. I mean, it's interesting. But do you think that there's something, I don't know if society's changed that much, but like where it's not cool for the guys? Are guys becoming more honest about wanting to say they have, to being able to say, yeah, I really want to have kids?
Well, all right. I mean, when we're talking about guys, I mean, we live in Brooklyn. We have a very particular set of kind of like a social circle that I think is not necessarily representative of all of America.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's true for sure.
I think that I would want children if I was a man, because mm-hmm. I would love to be a dad. I would love to be a part-time once in a while.
Me too. I've said that as well.
I'd be a father in a heartbeat. Yeah, I'd love to get a cookie for doing mm-hmm. the bare minimum with my mm-hmm. children. Like, mm-hmm. sign me up.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I think it's interesting. You know, it's kind of like the idea. The first thing I think about is the responsibility of it. But then again, that's the reason why I don't have a dog either. So, so my thinking, I think, is deep into it. But but I totally agree with that. I think it's a unique social situation, certainly in the Greenpoint, Williamsburg, Bushwick.
Yeah, it's not fair to generalize out of that, right?
But it's pervasive enough, the mentality within this borough, that I think you can make a generalization to a certain degree about a certain age group. There has definitely, I think, been a shift generationally, this mm-hmm. generation, about the choice. On both sides, and mm-hmm. the idea that even the mm-hmm. depth and the proclivity of the discussion about mm-hmm. Reproductive rights and control, to the point where it's like people can make the decision, say as a woman in their 20s, saying, okay, I want to be child free, but doesn't have to be a reason why. It's just
right.
Like there's no like deeper fucked up caveat. It's just
right.
I don't want to do this.
And I try to turn it around a lot on people sometimes. I think that when you do something that's considered not the norm socially, it's always fun to challenge people who do have the norm. So mm-hmm. when people really, really push at me and they're like, no, why don't you want to have mm-hmm. kids? Why? There must be some reason. I love to turn it back around on them and say, well, why do you want children?
Mm.
Because sometimes the reasons for wanting children can be just as selfish as the reasons for not wanting them.
Right, and unconscious. I think, yeah, the whole idea of not wanting children because it's selfish to not want them is just wrong. I think that's like just like not wrong or right. It's irrelevant.
Yeah, you can have good reasons and bad reasons mm-hmm. on both sides. And I think it's, you know, I love to, when a straight couple I know tells me that they're getting married, I always turn to the dude and ask if he's going to keep his name or not.
That's awesome.
And it's this really,
gotta love that.
It's this really
that's
little
aggressive.
Thing.
That's aggressive. No, that's awesome.
But they're always so blindsided, and you're like, yeah, we live in a world where that's still
a lot of
you
unconscious.
Think that you're like the most liberal Brooklyn, like progressive dude ever, and you just looked at me like I grew an extra head.
It's kind of, and that's an interesting approach too, because it's kind of like having your cake and eating, wanting to have your cake and eat it too, in terms of your lifestyle and your culture. It's like we're putting on mm-hmm. this veneer of being very avant-garde artist types who don't give a shit, but at the same time, we're still weighed down
okay,
by certain
values. 8 minutes. I got one more question, because you brought I heard you use this term twice, and I want to ask about you about the imposter syndrome.
Okay.
So that seems to be a hot button for you in some way, or is that something
for sure.
That, so
it's something
can you
I think
talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, I mean, I think, I don't know if I can say this for all women, but certainly for me, I still spend a lot of my life thinking that I don't deserve the things that I have. And it's, I think in some ways quite good for me, because it always makes me push myself harder
mm-hmm.
when I say, oh, I can't believe I got published in such and such publication. That's so amazing.
Mm-hmm.
I've been trying to do this for 10 years.
Mm-hmm.
I need to do it again so that they know I deserve it. And then it'll mm-hmm. make me go back and work harder and pitch more stories and get my stuff out there.
Mm-hmm.
Because if I write for them twice, maybe I'll believe, just like everyone else, that I deserve
mm-hmm.
this. And when you have a job, which everyone likes to tell you is their dream job, you start thinking, well, why do I have it? Why do I have it and not this other person who wants it? What am I doing that makes me so special? And it makes you just question your abilities and question whether you deserve it and question your talents and
mm-hmm.
how you're accomplishing things. And so it just makes you kind of second guess yourself.
Why do you think you second guess yourself? I mean, you've had so much success. Like, do you know where that, does that come from your childhood, or do you have any idea? Just, do you think it's being a woman?
I think being a woman has a lot to do with it. And not my parents, but I was raised, I mean, in the South, which is very mm-hmm. much a culture where a lot of the things that I wanted were not things that most women wanted. And always having to push, well, how come you get to do it? There's a saying in the South about there's a pot of lobsters and you don't have to put a lid on them when you're cooking them, because
mm-hmm.
if one tries to climb out, all the other ones will pull it back in. And I think tell people when I was growing up, you know, I think I want to be a writer when I grow up. You know, maybe I'm going to move to New York and be a journalist. And there was always this assumption that if you wanted something great, it meant that what you had wasn't good enough. And that in a way you were insulting them. And people really pushed back on themselves. Like, well, why do you want to live in New York? North Carolina is great. Are you saying that you want to live somewhere else? Because we're not good
enough. That's interesting.
And it makes you always wonder, do I believe those things?
So you came from a culture that doesn't want women to be ambitious. Is that it?
I don't know if they want anyone to be ambitious in that way.
Did your parents, like, what did they want you to do?
I will give my parents a lot of credit in the sense that my mom told me from childhood that she wanted me to do whatever I wanted to do. I think she felt like her own educational opportunities were not what they could have been because she wasn't at a deaf school. She didn't learn sign language until she was 18. She was sent to a mainstream school, and she knows that she missed out on a lot, and it wasn't her fault that she missed it. But I think she knew that I had the opportunity that she didn't,
right,
and always encouraged me to take it.
That's really cool. That's really cool. Christian.
Yes.
So did you know that Lilith Lilith had an imposter syndrome? Did you know that about her?
No, I don't think that's ever come across.
You would never guess that, right?
No, she's very self assured when I've talked to her. But I think in a way that's something that's very appealing because not to say that she's not human, but it definitely is a humanizing characteristic in the fact that we all have self doubt. And especially when it comes to the professional side, that's something I can totally relate to.
Oh, God, yeah. Well, I mean, I get this feeling that I think one of your charms, personally, Lilith, is that you are really ambitious and you are really like, you know, you got the goods and you do what you got to do. You don't take anything for granted. But I think at the same time, you do have a vulnerability and a humility underneath all that strength, all that, I don't want to call it bluster, but there's a power, you present in a very powerful, strong way. But I think there's something very real and vulnerable at the same time lurking behind it, which makes it inspiring and charming.
Well,
what do you think? What do you think? Does that make sense to you?
She's a very generous person, especially with the time that she has for her friends. It's interesting, even if you checked in on Lilith's Twitter and social media, she's very good about answering stuff and making time to check in with a very wide variety of people and stuff when she can.
We like
when
that.
When she's back home, which is
we
really
like
cool.
That.
In addition to making time for her cat, Brisket. Which
important.
Yes. Brisket has a Facebook page.
She does. And, you know, if we're talking about me being so single, I have to date dudes who like cats. That's really important.
How long have you been single?
I don't know.
Has it more than 5 years?
No.
Okay, that's fine then. I'm not worried about you. Okay, well, guess what? We've had the most fun ever.
Yeah,
well,
it's
been
really
fun.
We have 2.5 minutes left, so I want you guys to both talk about what's coming up and where we should go and, like, do a little promo. Let's let Christian go first because he's involved. He's the curator of humanity.
Thanks.
That is true.
So I'm the Brooklyn events co-coordinator for Nomadic Press. We're a literary nonprofit co-based out of Oakland and Brooklyn. And we do, in addition to our small press, live events, readings and whatnot. The next confirmed one that we have coming up is going to be on July 8th at the Brooklyn Art Library. That's going to be Project Comics, co-curated with me and Jeremy Nguyen, who's amazing. He's the in-house cartoonist at Bushwick Daily. We're going to be projecting comic book artists' work, and they four of them are going to be on site.
So what date is it?
That's going to be Friday, July 8th.
July 8th, the day after Radio Free Brooklyn benefit I'm throwing. So that's your Thursday and Friday. So come to both of them so we can all hang out and get to know each other really well.
Yep.
And how about you, Lilith? What have you got? What the hell are you doing? Nothing, obviously.
I'm actually in town for a while, which is really exciting. Sunday, I got back from a 2-week trip in Switzerland and France, which you will hopefully be reading more about soon.
Condé Nast Traveler.
Yes.
Awesome.
So I'm at Condé. I work for Condé Nast Traveler, but you can also follow me. I occasionally freelance and do other stuff. I'm at Lilith Marcus, MARCUS, on Twitter, and Lilith Goes on Instagram.
Yeah, so your Twitter account's pretty active, really.
Oh, God, it's like a drug. I can't stop.
And if I could just say that if anyone listening to this should totally check out her coverage over on Condé Nast Traveler for this recent Cuba trip. It's really, really cool.
Yeah, the first cruise?
Yeah, it was the first cruise from the United States to Cuba in more than 50 years. It was incredible.
That's so freaking amazing.
Yeah, so it was on a company called Fathom, and you can take them right now.
And you were on a cruise with all those people.
Yeah, it was amazing.
Stuck on that boat. That scares me.
You know, it wasn't that bad, actually. I had never been on a cruise before, so I wasn't sure. I thought I was going to get really claustrophobic, but it ended up being cool.
That's great. All right. So anyway, it's been. I'm learning how to get the show and bring it in on time,
Whoa.
Exactly on time, and
Hit
it's really
post.
Hard because I got like 4 seconds. So thanks to you guys.